I think with the possible exception of some of my colleagues who are here, none of us have heard Paul's opening speech to entering law students. But although none of us have heard that, we have all heard a dean's opening speech. And they're all more or less the same. Maybe you heard it from John Jeffries, maybe you heard it from Bob Scott, or Tom Jackson, or Dick Merrill, or Emerson Spees, or Monrad Paulson, or Hardy Dillard, or possibly Frederick Ribble or Armistead Dobie. But we've all heard one of these opening day speeches. The dean starts off with some fluff about the glorious history of law and lawyers, the glorious history of the University of Virginia Law School, a little bit, of course, about Thomas Jefferson. Then he tells you that law school is not about learning a lot of legal rules. And the dean says this partly to inoculate himself against the expected complaints, especially the complaints and anxieties of first-year law students who come to law school thinking that they are going to learn a lot of legal rules. November of the first year comes around, exams are looming on the horizon, and they realize that not only have they not learned a lot of legal rules, they haven't learned any. And they go and complain to the dean, and he reminds them that that's not what law school is for. Then in the opening day speech, the dean goes on and says, nor is law school about practical skills. It's not about learning where to stand in the courtroom. It's not about learning how to draft a complaint or a will or a trust or a contract. Again, trying to immunize himself in the institution against the expected complaints that law school is insufficiently practical. But if law school is not about these things, the dean says on the first day, then what is it about? Aha, the dean says pretentiously. Law school is about legal reasoning. It is about learning how to think like a lawyer. Recall Kingsfield in The Paper Chase. You come in here with a skull full of mush, and you leave thinking like a lawyer. But having said that law school is about learning how to think like a lawyer, the dean then retreats to fluff again and never actually tells the first year students what it is that to think like a lawyer or what legal reasoning really is. Nor, I should add, did Kingsfield. Nor do any of us who teach in the first year of law school. We claim that we are teaching students how to think like lawyers, but we never actually tell them what it is to think like lawyers. We assume that they will absorb this by osmosis, and we assume it the same way that people have assumed it for decades or generations, or whatever. So then the question, and the question I want to address now, is what is legal reasoning? What is it to think like a lawyer? One possibility, and a serious possibility, is that maybe there is nothing to it. There are serious skeptical challenges out there to the idea that there is something distinctive, something specially important about legal reasoning or legal thinking, as opposed simply to thinking or simply to reasoning. Indeed, that's what legal realists like Jerome Frank and Carl Llewellyn and William O. Douglas and Thurman Arnold and many others believed, with an important number of variations among them, but still at the core of many significant legal realist positions is the view that judges and lawyers are, in addition to being judges and lawyers, human beings. and that if we want to explain or understand how judges and lawyers think, we should understand how human beings think. And the biggest explanatory factor in determining what judges and lawyers do and how judges and lawyers think is the fact that they are human beings, rather than anything that they may have learned in the practice of law, anything that they may have learned in law school, anything that they may have learned on the bench. That it is their human beingness rather than their lawyerness or their judgeness that explains exactly what it is that they are doing. And there are other forms of skepticism as well, not necessarily associated with legal realism, but there is a serious view out there that lawyers are not in any way different, or in any significant way different in their thinking and reasoning processes from other people. Now, that doesn't mean that there are not good thinkers and bad thinkers. But under the skeptical view, the things that make lawyers and judges good thinkers and good lawyers and good judges are the same attributes that they share with good thinkers in various other disciplines. So yes, it is certainly important, the skeptics say, to recognize the value in lawyering and judging of analogical reasoning. It is important to understand the value of analytic thinking. It is important to understand the importance of hearing the other side of any argument or any position. But then so goes the argument. These are skills, analogical reasoning, analytic thinking, hearing all sides, and various other things. These are also important to policy analysts, detectives, physicians, chemists, plumbers, carpenters, and various other people. And as a result of this, although there are, so the skeptics say, good legal thinkers, good judges, what makes them good is the same things that make other people good at their professions, and that the whole idea that there is something distinctive or special about legal reasoning, that there is something we can identify as thinking like a lawyer, is basically a self-aggrandizing sham that's taken place since Christopher Columbus Langdell, in order to justify the existence of law schools and to justify the existence of a special lawyer class. I don't believe this. I think there may be something to legal reasoning. There may be something special or important about thinking like a lawyer. But in order to understand what it might be, in order to make the argument, we have to at least appreciate the fact that it is not plausible to claim that legal reasoning and legal thinking is entirely unique. Legal reasoning is not to reasoning what multivariate calculus is to poetry or Estonian is to Chinese. Obviously, there are closer connections between legal reasoning and reasoning, closer connections between legal thinking and thinking than we would find in terms of other far more disparate enterprises. Nevertheless, there may be things that are concentrated in legal reasoning. There may be forms of thinking, forms of analysis, forms of decision making, forms of reasoning that, although they exist in other disciplines, exist in other areas and enterprises, may exist more importantly and in a more concentrated form in law than elsewhere. And if we try to look for those, rather than looking for something that is entirely unique, we may get a start on identifying what is particularly special, if anything, about legal reasoning. It seems to me that one possibility, or one of the things that might be concentrated in law, and one of the things that we spend a fair amount of time on in the first year of law school, of course, is reasoning from precedent. When a judge thinks that a previous decision is right, that it's the correct decision, whether it be from the same court previously or from a higher court, precedent doesn't matter. As the late legal theorist Patrick Atiyah put it, the concept of a system of precedent is that it constrains judges in some cases to follow decisions they do not agree with. That precedent matters, or at least matters most, in those circumstances when a judge, all things considered, would have made a different decision, but nevertheless feels constrained by precedent to do something other than what she would have done had she been left entirely to her own devices without the constraints of precedent. Precedent operates largely when someone thinks, to repeat, that a previous decision is wrong, but thinks there is an obligation to follow it anyway. So too with rules. When a rule tells us to do what we would have done anyway, it matters far less, which is not to say it doesn't matter at all, but it matters far less than when a rule appears to command us to do something other than what we would have done had we not been constrained by the rule. Preparation for this talk, I did a little bit of research. For those of you who are unaware of this, the laws of the Commonwealth of Virginia prohibit cannibalism. You may not be interested in how I reached this conclusion, but I see that everybody is finished with lunch. Some combination of the laws against murder and the laws dealing with how one can deal with a dead body will produce the conclusion that cannibalism is against the law. Here, take my word for it. But it also turns out that, at least for me, I won't speak for any of you, if the Commonwealth of Virginia were to repeal its laws prohibiting cannibalism tomorrow, that would not change my eating habits one bit. At least as far as my decisional processes are concerned, the rules, the law against laws against cannibalism are largely inconsequential. Most rules, however, or many rules for many people, operate in a quite different way. When a rule dictates the wrong answer, when a rule tells us to do what we would not otherwise, all things considered, have done, then the rule appears to have its greatest bite. Obviously, rules play into our decisional processes, even if in the final analysis we agree with what a rule would say. But rules are most obvious and most constraining, and perhaps most important in law, when they tell us to do things other than what we would have done if the rule did not exist. It is when a rule dictates the wrong answer, but you have to follow it just because it is the rule, that rules matter the most. Indeed, we might imagine a scenario involving one of the rules that we confront all the time, speed limit 65. Obviously, that's a rule designed to achieve safety on the highways. It is designed for the average driver under average conditions in an average car. So suppose that I am out on a clear, dry Sunday morning with my clean driving record and my new car, and the weather is perfect and there are no cars on the road, and I am driving at 78. We all know you can drive more or less 9 miles an hour above the posted speed limit and you're safe, but the speed limit is 65 and I'm driving 78. I see the blinking light in the rear view mirror. I pull over. The officer says, you were going 78, the speed limit is 65. I then explain to the police officer, excuse me, officer, I'm not sure you understand. The speed limit is designed to ensure safe driving. I have a perfect driving record. You can look it up. There's no traffic. The weather is perfect. This is a new car. I am driving very safely. I am not violating the purpose of the rules, so obviously I should not be cited just because I am going above 55. Now, we all know what happens next. That's not an argument I am going to win. That even though the best, all things considered, decision might be that I am not driving unsafely or dangerously, I am violating the rule, and that's that. Sometimes in law, you have to follow a rule just because it is the rule. So too with the idea of authority. In law, more than in other areas, the fact that someone said so, the existence of an authority, the fact that it was said by a legislator, the fact that it was said by a judge, the fact that it was said by Wigmore about evidence or by Corbin about contracts, or by Prosser or Keaton about torts, or by Ken Abraham about insurance. I see him sitting there. I don't mean to insult or slight the rest of my colleagues. The fact that Ken says so about insurance makes a difference in law, even if the person who actually has to make the decision thinks that Ken is wrong. That's the very idea of authority. Often it at least inclines us or inclines legal decision makers in the direction of wrong answers. Indeed, we could add to this list of precedent and rules and authority the burden of proof, which often produces the outcome that people who are in fact guilty get off. But what ties all of these things together is a tolerance for the wrong answer. And it may very well be that that is at the heart of legal reasoning. That is what lies at the heart of thinking like a lawyer. Tolerating the wrong answer in the immediate case, in the service of process values or long-term values or something of that variety. Stability for stability's sake often. Brandeis famously said, in most matters, it is more important that the rule be settled than that it be settled right. It may be that law, more than in other decision-making enterprises, is willing to tolerate the wrong answer in the service of these systemic or process or longer term values. This plays out, of course, in at least one form of the typical first year Socratic dialogue. We've all been through this in some form or another. I'll make up a case. It's contracts class. There's a case involving a starving widow with five young children who buys a fuel oil contract from ExxonMobil. She doesn't pay. Exxon sues the starving widow with the five children. And some student is asked, what's the right result? Obviously, the students want the starving widow to win. They typically do not have an enormous degree of sympathy with ExxonMobil in these circumstances. And then the student is asked, why is that? Why should she win? And the student gives some rule or principle. And then, with the benefit of having taught the same course with the same hypotheticals for the last 37 years, we ask the student a series of patterned hypotheticals designed to show why the student's preferred result and the student's preferred rule would produce in the aggregate or in the long run more bad results. Maybe it's better to let the starving widow lose in this case. Maybe it's better to let ExxonMobil win here because in the aggregate, a better rule, a better outcome for the array of cases would be one in which Exxon wins and the starving widow loses, and eventually we hope students understand this. The larger lesson is that the best result, all things considered here, is not necessarily the best legal result. In that sense, thinking like a lawyer is necessarily non-particularistic. To the extent that you can see why it is sometimes good to reach a bad conclusion, then perhaps you have learned to think like a lawyer. And then, of course, once you have learned why it is sometimes good to reach a bad conclusion and learned that may be at the heart of thinking like a lawyer, you will have learned as well why there are a lot of people who don't like lawyers. But I'll leave that for my next talk. Thank you very much.